funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Quick, what's a nine-letter word for compelling game? Crossword puzzles first started appearing in newspapers in 1913. And by the 1920s, they had so many rabid fans that some people worried human productivity would grind to a halt. As my guest today will tell us, good puzzles balance humor, creativity, and challenge, and the very best contain delightful surprises for those who solve them correctly. Alan Connor writes a weekly column on crosswords for The Guardian, and he is a writer and host for the BBC. His new book is called Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. Alan, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
You say that a love of crosswords is also a love of language, but crosswords also take a delight in tricks and puns.
They do, and they are my favourite puzzles, I think, are the ones where, you know, you're filling in the grid and you get a word here and a word there, and then you notice that there's something else going on, that that there's some little trick being played. So you might find, I don't know, there's this thing called the spoonerism, where you swap the beginnings of the starts of words, and so you might see outcome of bighorn. And the crossing letters make you realise you're having to write in Custer Beaton, and you wonder why. And then you think of Buster Keaton, and then you see that you've also put in Mormon Naylor for a Utah carpenter, and you realise, okay, throughout this grid, we've got the names of famous people with the sound swapped around.
So the people who make these puzzles just have these remarkable brains.
They do, and you know, in researching this book, I found out they certainly don't do it for the money. they like a challenge, I think, and that's why you sometimes get these extra tricks in the puzzles, because once they get used to the already formidable task of having to cram pieces of language together, you know, that's not enough for them sometimes. It's the same for solvers. I suppose it's like any addiction. You know, you want to go the next stage up, and so their warped brains do come up with these ingenious bits of architecture.
What is a Nina in a crossword puzzle?
So Nina is a term that's used to describe these sort of hidden tricks, and it's used because of the cartoonist Al Hirschfeld, who, if your listeners don't know the name, they certainly would recognise the style of cartoon. And he did lots of editorial cartoons, and after the birth of his daughter Nina, he started slipping her name into his drawings. So it might be in the folds of a dress or in the lines of someone's hair. You would see that the letters N-I-N-A were spelt out. And because the same sort of thing happens in crossword puzzles, that's a term that some people use to describe these things where suddenly you look up the diagonal and you'll see there's an extra message in there that might be celebrating an anniversary or might even just be a sort of private message from the constructor of the puzzle to a loved one.
And, of course, there has been concern over time when there was war going on and there were questions about whether messages of espionage might be hidden in puzzles.
Yes, the British military were very, very sensitive during World War II, partly because, as I learned, the plans for D-Day, the Normandy landings, had... a few weeks before the planned invasion of France had blown out of a window into a London street. So they were very on edge about whether the Germans knew that that what they thought was about to happen, which was a bunch of British and American and Canadian troops landing in one part of France, was not true, and that that in fact they were going to land somewhere else. And so they were scouring everywhere for clues that might be going out to tell the Nazis this. They had a bunch of code words for this operation, and some of these spies liked to do crossword puzzles, unsurprisingly, I suppose, and they noticed that code word after code word was appearing in the crossword of one particular British newspaper, the Daily Telegraph. So Omaha, which was the name for one of the beaches, Overlord, which was the name for the operation itself, the code names for the landing stages. And they didn't know what to make of it other than to do what any spy would do, I suppose, which is to drive to go and find this crossword constructor, who was a schoolmaster, and yank him out of the school, put him in a big black car and interrogate the bejesus out of him.
And what were they able to, what did they conclude?
Well, in the end, they concluded it was a coincidence because they couldn't see, they couldn't, the constructor seemed perfectly innocent. They couldn't find any links between him and enemy agents or the Germans. And it wasn't until decades later that one of his pupils, a boy at the school, wrote to the Daily Telegraph and said, well, I've got something to confess. Our school was near a training camp for British, for American and Canadian soldiers. And we used to go and, you know, hide up the trees and watch them and listen to them. And we heard all these funny words like Omaha and Neptune and Overlord. We didn't know what they were, but we started using them. And when our teacher asked us, he would sometimes say, boys, I've got another crossword puzzle to do. You come up with the words, I'll put them in the grid, and then I'll come up with the clues. Without knowing that they were going to get him into trouble, they started suggesting these words. So it was a sort of horrible coincidence, which in a time of war, I suppose you don't want to think of things as having innocent explanations. So hence the interrogation.
It is a delightful story after the fact. I'm sure it was terrifying for him in the moment.
It must have been. It's funny looking at World War II through the kind of the crossword prism, as it were, because crosswords up till that point were thought of as a very jolly good thing in Britain. I don't know if your listeners would know, there's a place that's very close to the hearts of lots of British people called Bletchley Park. And Bletchley Park is where codebreakers were trying to break the signals that Nazis were sending to each other. They'd intercepted the signals, but they were encoded. And they didn't know what they had to say. And they decided that they needed some people with what they called warped brains. So what they did was they ran a fake crossword competition. And people turned up expecting that they'd just be filling in a puzzle, and there was a sort of promise given. If enough people complete this puzzle quickly enough, we'll donate some money to a charity that deals with victims of mines. What in fact was going on was that those who solved it very quickly were then asked to immediately to go and report to a Colonel Leonard, who said to them, right, I've got some work for you. And what they wanted these people to do was to go to Bletchley Park, because they thought that the sort of people who knew what letters tend to come where and were good at kind of spotting hidden messages and cramming bits of language together and regarding it, not in the way that we all regard language, you know, you don't really think about it, you just kind of read it and speak it, but people that enjoyed picking it apart were exactly the right sort of people to have at Bletchley. And in the end, Winston Churchill reckoned that the code-breaking work that was done at Bletchley may have reduced the length of the war by 1 or possibly 2 years. So if anyone ever says to you, don't you think crosswords are a bit of a silly waste of time, you can say, well, you know, they did save, they saved Europe from Nazi oppression.
You know, one thing I think that's great about crosswords is that it's almost the opposite of a game like Scrabble, where you can be exceptionally good at creating words on the board out of thin air with no knowledge whatsoever of what they mean and no need to put them into context.
Yeah, I've noticed that that's been happening with kind of competitive Scrabble, that in the last couple of decades, the kind of people who win aren't who you would have expected to be Scrabble champs, you know, a few decades ago, tweedy people that love nosing through a dictionary. They're computer people, and they're people who don't necessarily have English as a first language, but people who are very good at memorising lots and lots of words and jamming them together. With crossword puzzles, I don't think there's much point particularly in doing one if that's your approach to language. You know, you may as well do a Sudoku if you just like kind of fitting things together and finding the answer. The joy of a crossword is recovering some piece of information or a name or a place name that you had in your brain, and also seeing these sort of extra silly games that the constructors play with you.
Tell us about how the very first crossword puzzles worked, because they looked a little bit different than the form we associate with crosswords today.
Yeah, I think they look kind of ugly and a bit ghastly. you know, I've tried to solve these very early puzzles, and I got stuck not on the clues, but even knowing where to write in the answers, because the conventions that we take for granted of one across, two down, weren't there. The very first crossword, in fact, had a diamond shape, was one thing you noticed about it, and a sort of bizarre system of saying where the answers had to go. It's not that surprising in retrospect that it looks hasty, because it was hasty, the very first crossword puzzle. Shall I talk a little about the this poor man who had to invent a puzzle in a panic? His name was Arthur Wynne. He was a Brit. British people tend to think of the crossword as a very British thing, but it isn't, because Arthur left the United Kingdom at the turn of the century, hoping to make his fortune, as so many people do, and he went to what was then called the New World of America. He wanted to be a journalist. A Pulitzer never came his way. He did end up working for a newspaper called the New York World, but the section he was in charge of was called Fun, and it was the Sunday section, which was a couple of pages of puzzles and you know, silly diversions. And you know, life was ticking along, and he was happy in his rut until December 1913, when the editor said, "We're going to have twice as much fun this week. I want four pages of puzzles." Poor Arthur, of course, only knew so many puzzles, and so he had two choices, I suppose. He could leave some blank space and lose his job and be destitute in New York City, or he could supplement these word searches and things that he was populating the page with something new. And so he came up with this idea. Okay, I'll have a grid. He didn't know what to call it. He called it a word cross. He didn't know how to describe what the solver had to do, but he knew he had to explain that. You know, like any new challenge, you sort of you have to explain it in a way that seems quite quaint in retrospect. So this diamond grid had these instructions underneath saying, "Fill in the small squares with words which correspond to the following definitions." They didn't even have the word clue then. Hmm. At that point, the word clue still meant a ball of wool. That was the original sense of the word clue, and it assumed this metaphorical sense because you might use a ball of wool to find your way out of a maze.
Sure, as you unravel. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So this metaphor then became a word that we don't think too much about today. And so there he was, and he'd filled this space. Everything was okay. As I say, I don't think it's a tremendously good puzzle. One answer appears twice in the across and the down, which you'd never allow nowadays. And there are some pretty obscure words in there, like the names of Russian rivers and old Scottish words for a fist. I guess nowadays you still sometimes, there are some words you only see in crossword puzzles. But, you know, he'd invented this word cross, and I think that's a greater glory than any Pulitzer, because of course it then evolved. You know, it didn't just stay as this funny little diamond that he'd done. People started getting hooked on them, and it became better and better as time went on.
We're speaking this hour with Alan Connor. He writes a weekly column on crosswords for The Guardian, and he is a writer and host for the BBC. His new book is called Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. I know many of you out there may be crossword fans. If you'd like to join the conversation, tell a story, ask a question, call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with BBC host and writer Alan Connor. His new book is called Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Alan, there was Arthur Wynne who got us started down this road. And actually, women played an important role in the evolution of the crossword into what we recognize today.
That's right. And still nowadays, the crossword is primarily a female pursuit, or it skews slightly female. But the crossword as we know it is as much the work of one Margaret Petheridge, who also wanted to be a journalist, also had big ambitions, also found them initially thwarted. She got a job at the New York World, but being young and being female, it was thought that all she was capable of was checking Arthur Wynne's puzzles. So that was her job, and that then went on to encompass dealing with the letters of complaint that came in when clues were wrong or the puzzles were too hard or too easy, or removed, which is a sort of tradition of crosswords that goes on to this day. I remember an editor of a newspaper told me, you know, you can switch the politics of the newspaper, you can fire the star columnist, but for God's sake, don't move the crossword. That's the thing that really gets the readers going. And I suppose she paid attention to these complaints, and she looked with a very sharp eye at the crossword puzzle and worked out what was satisfying and what wasn't satisfying. And she began to establish some conventions that are still used, still followed by constructors. Nowadays, no two-letter words, no areas of the grid that are hard to get into. You know, make sure there's lots of nice interlocking. The symmetry of the grid and where any black squares might occur, that sort of thing. And she made it a much more satisfying puzzle for the solver. The counter effect of that, I suppose, is that these restrictions made them much harder to construct for the constructors. But that tends to be the way with crossword puzzles. The ones that that are most satisfying to do are the ones that that the constructor has found most frustrating to put together. And she eventually left the New York World, and she went to work for a publishing company founded by a Mr. Simon and a Mr. Schuster, who had got together and decided they were going to publish some books, but they didn't have any manuscripts. And so they were at a bit of a loss of what to do. And one of them discovered that his niece was hooked on these puzzles in the New York World. You know, they had a following. It wasn't huge at this point. And they thought, well, you know, we could do a book of crossword puzzles as our first publication. Obviously, we won't put the name Simon and Schuster to that because our aspirations are a little higher than something that silly. So they looked around and saw the name of their telephone exchange was Plaza. So they then founded this imprint, Plaza Publishing. Got Margaret Petheridge in. She collected some puzzles together. They printed them up. You got a free pencil with the book. And we're in 1925 by now. So at the start of the year, crosswords are a minority pursuit. By the end of the year, Simon and Schuster have topped the non-fiction bestseller list three or four times. And America has gone absolutely crossword crazy. In that way that America liked to embrace things a bit too much in the 1920s.
And not so, really all the time. if we like something, we like it a bit too much.
But with the 1920s, that was turned up to 11, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was, even Mahjong was a national craze. I think that was the 1924 kind of fad. And then in 1925, you would find that perfectly sensible women could walk into a boutique and come out wearing a dress that made them look like a crossword puzzle or some earrings with black and white squares on. You could go to and see a Broadway musical called The Puzzles of 1925 that depicted people in a special puzzle sanatorium because they were so hooked on these crazy puzzles.
And there were people who were legitimately worried. It reminds me of the debate we're having now over our phones and how distracted we are. They were afraid people would not get anything productive done.
Yeah, there was a proper moral panic, particularly in the United Kingdom. the New York correspondent of the London Times wrote this report saying, "You won't believe what's going on in America. They've gone mad. they're all doing these puzzles." And the Times said, "Well, they better not come over here." And the tenor of these reports was that that men were filling in these puzzles when, of course, they should be, you know, devoting every waking hour to toil for the benefit of their employers. And if women were doing them, well, that was even worse because they were obviously neglecting their children if they were doing crossword puzzles. And, yeah, you could take one of these sort of scary reports. The New York Times joined in as well. You could take one of them and kind of do a find and replace of the word crossword with, you know, video games, and you would have a new story from the 1990s, or, yeah, as you say, like Facebook or Twitter, and you could have an identical news story that could go out in a newspaper today.
What sort of form do crosswords take in languages other than English?
I don't think they're as good. And, you know, that's not just because I'm not very good at speaking any other languages. if you look at the puzzles in non-English languages, there's a lot more proper nouns in there. They don't tend to have, you don't get the name of the constructor. And that's because they're much more anonymous puzzles. I suppose they are... There's an expectation that they're for sort of old people or people visiting old people in hospitals, and they're not really thought of as particularly cerebral. And I think the reason for that is the peculiar nature of the English language, which I suppose because the English language comes from England, which was a country that historically has enjoyed going abroad and, let us say, borrowing things from other countries, like their people and their stuff. So too has the English language borrowed lots and lots of words. So, you know, if you were to look up the English language on Wikipedia, it would say a Germanic language. But of course, you know, there are lots of words from Latin and Greek and little loan words that we've taken from all around the world. And the effect of that is that lots of words have many different meanings. And for lots of things in the world, there are lots and lots of different ways you can describe them. So German, a language like that, a much more precise language, is a bit... If you do a crossword puzzle in German, it's a bit like filling in a form because the language is so precise about what it's describing. Whereas in English, you don't know if someone, you know, if you see, I need a four-letter word and the clue is press, well, that could be urge or it could be iron because, you know, it's such a messy language. And that mess that makes English very hard to learn for non-native speakers also makes it very fun to play games with it if you have sort of managed to get this crazy language into your head.
One of the clues that you list in the book that is just a great one is it's just sort of a tricky pun. It's it would look like, when you first read it, supporter of wicked things. So you think about someone who is doing something awful. And then the answer turns out to be candlesticks. So it's supporter of wicked things. If you go back around and twist it, and I suppose you have to do that often with clues.
Yeah, and it's that sort of hit that you get in your brain, for me, is the same sort of thing as when you hear a good joke. Mm-hmm. You know, if you like a clue, if you enjoy a clue like that, the what happens in your head is like your favourite comedian telling you a pun, or your favourite relative making a kind of bit of wordplay. So there's another one along the same lines that I like, which is you read it as number of people in a theatre. And of course, you know, automatically think of a theatre where you might go and see a dramatic production. As more letters come in, you say, "Can this be? Is this like? I can't remember what the American term is. In Britain, we say anaesthetist,
anaesthesiologist."
Anaesthesiologist. So you look at it again and you go, "Oh, so the theatre is an operating theatre, and this number is not a number like 1, 2, or 3. This is someone that numbs." And it's that ambiguity that, you know, dark forces in our world will use the ambiguity of the English language to sell us things or to tell us lies. But the saints, I would say, of the constructing world use it to make us smile.
Are creators these days using software to make building the puzzle easier? Or are these things still pretty much done by hand?
You know, I'm sure there are some people who are kind of holding out and saying, nope, I just use some graph paper and a pencil. But, you know, if your puzzle's been printed in a newspaper, it's got to arrive in digital form in order for it to be incorporated into the process that gets that newspaper out there. Mm-hmm. So at some point, yeah, you're going to be using a computer. And the effect of that is that the software that will pull up a grid for you and allow you to say, OK, this is what I want to have, I want to cross, will also start suggesting words. You know, if you get stuck, it will tell you, oh, well, you know, you could get out of this fix because there is a four-letter word that will help you make all these things crisscross there. Now, that's a slightly kind of scary proposition. And, you know, when I first realised that was what was going on, I thought, oh, is this going to take the soul out of the business of construction of crosswords? But I suppose what it does is that it puts even more water between the really good ones, the really good constructors, and the lazy ones. Because if a piece of software tells you, well, you know what, this grid that you've got 90% of the way to filling, you can fill up the rest of it if you use this four-letter word. It's the place name of a small settlement in Alaska, population 99. A good constructor will say, you know what, if I put that in, I'm not going to work anymore. There'll be letters to the editor, or I'm above that. So it hasn't had as scary an effect as I think, and at least it means they don't have to spend as much time with graph paper and pencils.
Well, you make the point that it's fine to play some tricks, but puzzle constructors have to be fair.
Yeah, and I think this is something that often isn't grasped by novice constructors, and I include myself in that. So the first time I tried to put a puzzle together, I remembered, you remember the tough clues, and you think, oh, I better make this, a real fiendish challenge. And in fact, that's not your job at all. You know, your job is to lose, but to lose gracefully. Your job is to construct a grid with some nice strategically placed easy answers that will get people going. And even the harder ones, you might want the person, the solver, to be baffled for a moment, but you absolutely want them to get there and to fill it in, and ideally to have the penny drop moment of realization. So yeah, I suppose you want to put up a fight. You want to let the solver win, but you want to let them feel that they've achieved something by winning. What you don't want is the solver to kind of toss down the newspaper with 30% of the square still with nothing written in them, saying, well, that was a waste of time.
I absolutely love the chapter where you talk about the puzzle that came out just before the 1996 U.S. presidential election.
It's an extraordinary puzzle. It's one of the greatest puzzles, I think, that was created. So, 1996, and the presidential election result is going to be announced the next day. And there's a puzzle in the New York Times, and one of the clues says, lead story in tomorrow's newspaper. And you've got the word elected in this grid, and you've got seven cells leading up to it. And what you got from those seven cells was almost a matter of chance because of the words that intersected with them. So, for example, the first of these cells intersected with a clue, and the clue was Halloween animal. And you might have got the A and the T already for there. And you might think, oh, well, that's bat. But you might equally think, oh, well, that's cat. So you might have a B or a C.
B for Bob Dole, C for Clinton.
B for Bob Dole, C for Clinton. Mm-hmm. And for the next one along, French 101 word, and you might have got the UI underneath, and you might think, oh, well, that's oui, or you might think that's Louis, you know, both very common French words. O for the second letter in Bob Dole, L for the second letter in Clinton. And once you've got a few of these, you know, you would then end up kind of constructing the rest of the puzzle around your hunch as to whether you were supposed to be writing in Bob Dole, seven letters, or Clinton, seven letters. But you wouldn't be doing this casually, and people weren't. They were absolutely flabbergasted that the crossword puzzle the day before the election result came out was purporting to predict the result of that election. So poor old Will Shorts, the editor of the puzzle, was getting these phone calls from people saying, "Are you out of your mind? What are you? How dare you try and predict the outcome? Or how dare you say that Bob Dole should be winning this election?" But in fact, it was this constructor, Jeremiah Farrell, his name was, had done what we were talking about earlier. He decided, OK, I'm going to give myself an extra challenge here. And I have a slightly fanciful way of thinking about this puzzle. It's like a kind of Schrödinger crossword in that there are two equally valid outcomes in it. And it's masterful.
Yeah, it's remarkable how angry people became if they assumed that it didn't occur to them that there were two ways to solve all those other clues.
No, because, you know, most puzzles don't work that way. And once you've got the C and the L of Clinton or whichever letters you got, as far as you knew, that was the only valid solution to this puzzle. And what on earth were they playing at?
And has that idea been duplicated elsewhere?
Yeah, it's. I think that was sort of in the crossword world. That was a big deal. And in fact, another constructor years later did a little sort of tribute puzzle to this, to which the equivalent of Bob Dole and Clinton was four-time Tour de France winner or five-time Tour de France winner. And this was when Lance Armstrong was about to possibly win his fifth Tour de France. And there was a kind of hidden tribute to Jeremiah Farrell, the original constructor, in there. So I think it's one that, you know, most ingenious constructors would love to be able to replicate. But the kind of architecture and the sweat that goes into that must make it a very rare thing to be able to accomplish.
Alan Connor is with us. He writes a weekly column on crosswords for The Guardian, and he writes and hosts for the BBC. His new book is called Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with BBC writer and host Alan Connor, who also writes a weekly column on crossword puzzles for The Guardian. His new book is called Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
I work New York Times crossword puzzles every day, and the story is that each day is harder than the one before through Saturday. And I wonder how it seems that they're right when they say that to me, but I don't know how they decide. How does an editor or a writer decide that one puzzle is harder than another?
Alan?
Such a good question, and it's one that I've encountered myself recently in a slightly different context, which is I've become what they call the question editor for a BBC quiz show, and you know, in the final at the end of the series, we want the questions to be harder than they are at the beginning, and you suddenly realise that what you're having to do is to try and imagine what everyone watching a show or solving a puzzle, what they know and what they might not know. And of course, as I said earlier, you want them to kind of know everything, but you want some of these kind of words and facts to be harder to retrieve. And so I think a lot of it is intuition. I think you learn on the job because, you know, you learn that people say, well, you know, how could I be expected to know the name of this this sportscaster who hasn't broadcast for 20 years or whatever? And you start to realise that, in a way, you're a curator of the of your nation's cultural heritage. I know that sounds kind of fanciful, but everything that goes on is up for grabs in a crossword, but some musicians are better known than others. Some pieces of terminology are better known than others. And so I suppose you pay attention, you read the newspaper, you notice which names are coming up more often, which bits of language are used more often, which words are a bit obscure. And you file the more obscure ones under difficult and shove them in on a Friday, and you give people a bit of a rest on the Monday.
It turns out because of the sort of structural, formal limitations of crosswords, there are particular words that end up as crossword answers far more often than one would hear them in everyday conversation.
Yeah, I kind of love these words. So, when did you last say to describe the fact that, you know, your brother's gone on a cruise? Oh, well, he's a sea. You wouldn't say that.
Right.
But that, you know, that word A-S-E-A is there in the dictionary. And so it's kind of it's fair game for a crossword solver to use it. And you know, they're going to be tempted to use it a lot because there aren't that many words that have that combination of letters that are particularly useful for crossing with the other letters. You know, you want A's and E's and S's and words like that. And in fact, there's a what they call a web developer, Noah Veltman, and he decided to kind of throw some data at this because he was enjoying noticing that Ollie-O, you know, the fat, and Smee the pirate from Peter Pan were appearing a lot. And he did this incredible thing where he took the corpus of words in Google Books and a kind of store of all the words that had been used in the New York Times crossword and ran a program to say, okay, which words are kind of overrepresented in crossword puzzles. I think, you know, some constructors try and avoid using them because they feel that maybe it's a bit stale to be using a word like that comes up time and time again. For me, you know, I think of those words like friends. Uh-huh. You know, they kind of, you go, oh, okay, this is going to be assy again. When do you ever say that? But, you know, thank goodness I can write this in.
Right. Is it cheating if we pull out a dictionary or these days, I guess we could go on Google trying to figure out the answer to something?
Well, I do it. And I don't feel bad about it always. I feel bad if it's very early on in my solving of a puzzle because I think, well, you know, what's the point of this? You may as well start looking them up from the beginning, and in which case you may as well not be doing the puzzle at all. But, you know, I tend to think by the time you get to the end of a puzzle, if you're completely stuck, if you just don't know the name of that sportscaster, there's no great kudos in saying, well, you know, I didn't manage to finish this, but, you know, at least I didn't go and, you know, improve my knowledge or my word power. I think the whole thing of cheating is it's entirely up to you. And some people sort of, they tend to assume that it should be unarmed crossword, combat doing a crossword puzzle, that you should just have a pencil and it's your brain against the constructor's brain. But, you know, there's no rules that come printed next to the puzzle saying that. And the point of it is fun. And if you've decided, well, I like doing this crossword puzzle with my husband, you know, then you're asking someone else. And so, yeah, it's up to you. If you want to set yourself a stiff challenge, that's great. But that's a kind of imposition you've placed on yourself.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Brian on the line in Denton. Hello, Brian.
Hi.
Ty, go right ahead, please.
Well, my wife and I, we've been together 13 years or so. When we got together, that was one of our things we shared, was our love for crossword puzzles. I found 12 or 13 across clues and another 12 or 13 down clues, all the answers of which were parts or all of Kimberly Ann Turner, her name at the time. So she had 13 answers across, questions across, that she answered Kimberly Ann Turner. And so I found 25 or 27 different answers, the answers to which were her name.
That is so romantic.
That's great.
I love that.
It was just something fun, yeah. We like I say, we would do puzzles over the phone together. We would pick up a Friday New York Times, get as far as we could. It took us a year to get her here from California to Texas, so we would do this as part of a way to pass the time on the phone.
That's a great story. Thanks
so much.
That's
great. And some people take that to a further level, I've noticed. There's almost a sort of tradition now of every couple of years, the crossword editor of some paper or another will get contacted by someone who will say, I do the crossword puzzle with my girlfriend. I'd like to propose to her. Is there any chance you could construct a puzzle with her name in and some words like marry and ring and ideally yes? And every so often, you know, the editors and the constructors, you know, they go, okay, yeah, we'll do one of these. And I like those partly because they're lovely stories, but partly because it's a reminder that puzzles can be a social activity. You know, that they don't have to be something that that the kind of tired worker is doing on public transport on their way home. You know, it can be a kind of a group thing, a family thing, a workplace thing that's social and sort of cohesive.
What did you learn about the claims, Alan, that crossword puzzles keep our brains vibrant as we age?
Well, sadly, I learned that they're not particularly true, by which I mean they're not true. so, yeah, in Britain this week, there was a story in one of our tabloid newspapers that said, avoid Alzheimer's, do as many crosswords and Sudokus and jigsaws as you can. And you get a lot of these stories in papers, as in newspapers. So I thought, well, I better have a look at this. So I looked in a different kind of paper, as in academic papers, scientific papers. And, you know, every so often someone tries to test this claim. And it's a little like those stories you used to hear about if you play your baby some Mozart in the womb and in its crib.
Give birth to a genius.
You'll give birth to a genius who'll be speaking three languages by the time he's 6 months old. And, of course, that's nonsense. And, unfortunately, it seems to be the same thing with crossword puzzles, with one exception, which was I was talking to a psychology researcher who told me that she had found that this business of doing puzzles with other people did seem to have some sort of effect on keeping the parts of your brain going that make connections. Because I suppose if you're sort of getting halfway there to understanding a sort of wordplay-based clue and someone else comes up with the rest of it, that is something that is good for the brain. And also I'd say, you know, if you're having fun and if you're enjoying yourself and doing a sort of, you could call it an intellectual activity, I suppose, every morning, every evening or whatever, that's an end in itself, you know. You don't need a kind of doctor's note to justify that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Brett on the line now in Burleson. Hey, Brett.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a bit of an offbeat question. Is it possible to run across puzzle books that, shall we say, are not made in the United States or even Britain? Because I'm working through a large puzzle book that I got at a very low price at a bargain book store, and I'm running across answers that are not just posers or head scratchers for me. They are just flat wrong. They have clues that are not the proper definition even of the word. And I'm wondering if it's possible to buy a work that was put together by, say, a linguistics graduate student in China doing an English crossword puzzle as their thesis.
Wow. Well, Brett, maybe you get what you pay for. I don't know. Have you heard about that, Alan?
It wouldn't surprise me. Or, you know, there might be some computer somewhere putting these things together. You know, we talked earlier about complaints that newspapers receive when there's a problem with their crossword puzzle. And I've noticed that these complaints come in far more often when that newspaper's crossword is bought in, when it's a kind of syndicated, mass-produced, what I like to think of as landfill crosswords. Mm. And there's a big difference between those and the ones which have had more care put into them, where there's a kind of a pool of setters and the editor will kind of finesse the clues and change some. So it would not surprise me in the least. In fact, it sounds like quite a good money-making scheme, although immoral.
How do you could you tell someone who probably uses pencil from someone who probably uses pen just by looking at them or talking to them for 5 minutes?
Well, I think you can, because I think as you pick up that pencil or that pen, you're kind of saying something about yourself. If you're picking up a pen, you're saying, once I've come to a decision, that is a decision I am absolutely sticking to, and I don't want to get into a position in the future where I have to change that decision. So once I write that answer in, it's because I know it's right. If you're using a pencil, I suppose it's because you're the sort of person who embraces ambiguity and unexpected outcomes, and the sort of person that knows that you might see press and it's four letters, and it might occur to you to write iron in, but later it might turn out to be urge. So I think pen people are kind of more decisive people. That sounds like a compliment, but equally, I think pencil people are people who are open to the strangeness and unexpected ambiguities of the world. So, yeah, I would say it tells you something very profound about someone, which one they pick up.
Talking to puzzle constructors, is puzzle block, writer's block, an issue for them?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, when I've tried constructing puzzles, there are various blocks that you can hit. You can kind of fill 75% of a grid and then realise there's no way that you can fill up that remaining corner in a satisfying way. And the only thing you can do is unpick this thing that you'd absolutely invested so much in and thought, oh, these are brilliant words and great clues. Well, you've got to toss them. And I guess coming up with kind of new ways of cluing the same old words, is a challenge. And, I think that's why a lot of constructors enjoy going for a walk to clear the brain. And I know a lot of British constructors, that walk might be to the pub. and then after a couple of pints of warm ale, inspiration will dawn.
And tell me about your approach when you go the next day and look at the solution if you happen to need it. What are you looking for?
I'm looking for the ones that I haven't got. Mm-hmm. But sometimes if there's one of those clues, there was one that I saw in the LA Times yesterday or today, which was French bread, and it was four letters. And I thought, well, I can't squeeze baguette into four letters. And I thought, oh, maybe it's the French for bread. And then I remembered that's pain, so that was okay. Mm-hmm. But that didn't fit with the letters which crossed. And I didn't know what to do. Now, in this case, I'm not going to have to look in tomorrow's solution to see what it was, because I worked out it was euro, because bread was being used in the sense of money. But when that penny hasn't dropped, sometimes looking at the answer isn't enough. You want to know why, and that's why you go off to crossword blogs.
Alan Connor writes a weekly column on crosswords for The Guardian, and he is a writer and host for the BBC. He joined us from the BBC studios today. His new book is called Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. Alan, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
I've had a lovely time. Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.